This episode is supported by New Yonder. New Yonder is a curated global streaming service and certified B Corp that takes you on a journey across every corner of the globe, from the Arctic to the tropics, all from your sofa, with 5% of streaming sales going towards regenerative impact projects. Subscribe and stream today. Get 20% off your first 3 months for UK monthly subscribers using the code DEEPSEA20. Terms and conditions apply for a limited time only. New Yonder. A world of stories await. One of their regenerative projects is seagrass planting, and so that one gets my vote. There's some terrestrial ones as well, but yeah, I like that one. Hello and welcome to the Deep Sea Podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Lindley. With me is the Professor Alan Jameson. How are you doing, mate?
I'm all right.
We've got stories to tell.
Got myself in a bit of a pickle.
You've had a wee hoo-ha.
I have. I find myself in somewhat of a kerfuffle. But there's a silver lining, of course.
There always is. Describe your surroundings. Where are you?
I'm in an empty apartment. I'm 3 days into a 5-day quarantine in an empty apartment near a gas station about an hour south of Tijuana in Mexico. I'm all on my own because it took me 61 hours to get to Ensenada from Wellington, New Zealand, which is where I was last week, which is another story. But so I had the worst journey in the world. Lost all my luggage. It's not even coming now.
Wait, it's just gone, your luggage?
No, it's been rediverted back to Perth because I've only got 5 days quarantined before I'm joining a ship for 48 days. The guy basically said there's no way your luggage is getting to Ensenada.
Wow.
Or they couldn't guarantee it. And even if it did, we'd be long gone by then. So
they just gave up.
Yeah. And so because I'm in quarantine, very strict quarantine, so is everybody else on the ship. But they're all having a great time up the road. But because I was late.
They're in the party house.
I'm at the solitary confinement house again, which is all. This is the second time this has happened to me now. And some nice people have been driving around to the Walmarts of the world and buying me clothes and leaving them outside. So I've now got enough clothes for several days that's got to last me about 56 now or 46 days, whatever it is. I can't remember now. So yeah, the joys of deep sea research in the age of COVID.
Yeah. So locals are bringing you offerings. You're having things left at your doorstep and they back away, bowing and in fear.
No, it's not even that. They don't tell you. They just come and leave it and text you and then say, I've left something at your door. But they don't text you until they've gone, just in case you accidentally meet at the door. But I'm not allowed to go to the door anyway, so why would I?
In case you jump out and get them.
Yeah. So I'm in an empty flat. I've got a lovely fridge. That's what I'd say. I've got a beautiful fridge, but I've got no kettle or toaster and the TV don't work. So.
Oh, so you've been productive then, because you've got nothing else to do.
Well, the funniest story was a couple of nights ago, I thought I'd be really productive and make spaghetti bolognese. Right, I thought I'd make the bolognese, so I took, they've left some food for me, right, so I cooked it all up, it was great. Tried to cut an onion with a blunt knife, and I cooked it all up, and I had some, I thought that's great, and I thought what I'll do is I'll decant that into a bowl for later, and realised there are no bowls, and there's no other pans. So yesterday I had to have bolognese for breakfast, lunch and dinner, so I could get my pan back.
For the next batch cook.
Yeah, don't think ahead is a lesson to be learned there, people. Don't think ahead. Just eat what you want at the time, or you'll find yourself without a pan.
Cool. Well, this sounds great for your mental health. This is all going well. But it will all be for something. Can you talk about why you're heading out, where you're heading out the cruise?
Yes, we are leaving from Ensenada and spend 22 days going across to Hawaii. And we'll stop at 7 times across what's the Murray Fracture Zone. So it's a fracture zone north of the Clarion, which you've probably heard of. And deploy all the gear there 7 times equidistantly along to Hawaii, and then take a hard left and then do another 7 stations all the way down to Tahiti. So that'll be about 5,000 or 6,000 nautical miles transit. And then I swap over with someone else and they'll take a different line back up to Hawaii and a different line back over to San Diego. And then 2 months later, we'll all come back and do the whole thing again, but run another transit in between the previous two to Hawaii. And in between the previous two to Tahiti with more gear. And at some point around Christmas, the whole operation will be somewhere in the vicinity of Pacific Islands, somewhere down, somewhere hot. So, but before we get into any of the rest of the podcast, I have to apologize because my little house is also next to a big toll road and there's massive juggernauts coming past every 30 seconds that shake the place to bits. There's big Americans are going up to California. And so you might hear some mad thunder going on, but it's not just big American juggernaut. Love them.
We're struggling a little bit with sound tech this time. So your cruise, we talk a lot about the vast unknown Middle Pacific because it costs too much to get there. We've got very few data points from right out there in the middle. And here it is. You're filling in these blanks.
Yeah.
Because some of the places you're going are hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the nearest data point.
Yes.
Which was probably taken in like the 1900s.
That's the point, is to get right into the interior of the Pacific.
The meat of the Pacific.
Yeah.
Get right in there. Yeah.
Get off the shelf, mate. Get into the interior. That's the aim of the game.
That's a deep sea motto.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole program is lots of different things. This is not a trenchy one. It's not a fracture zone one. It's the abyssal plain one. So we'll finish this big transit. So that'll be by the end of this year, that'll do. There'll be six big transits across the Pacific. But then there's one more coming up next year, which will be from Tahiti all the way to Chile. And so that'll complete that big square, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. I mean, to be fair, this might be the single most boring data set we ever collect.
But then we know.
Then we know. Someone's got to do it, right? It doesn't all have to be sexy.
Yeah, fill in those blanks.
But anyway, I was talking about the silver lining to my kerfuffle.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was the spag bol.
No, not at all. No. The silver lining is that I find myself here with nothing. And so I have no microphone of which to talk to you except for my earbuds. But because I've got such a big empty apartment, I've got nothing but a laptop and some earbuds, I can walk around. I'm actually having a cup of tea right now, which is a far cry from the days of being squashed into my wife's wardrobe. And so this is almost liberating.
The freedom.
This is the first time I've ever done a walk around podcast.
Oh, give us a good old tea slurp. Good old British tea slurp.
Oh, that's good.
I feel refreshed by that.
Yeah.
I feel better.
Yeah, and it's also English breakfast tea as well, Tom. You'd like appreciate that.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
In a big mug, in a big builder's
mug. Of course, yeah.
Milky.
Milky. Anyway, we're talking about deep sea again, aren't we? Yeah.
Yeah, it's written on the podcast, I think. Oh, I could talk about why I'm missing lovely British tea.
Why?
Why I sound a little bit different. Because I've looked out the window and there's New Zealand out there.
Is there?
Yeah, there is.
It's not the old Zealand, is it? Are you sure it's the New Zealand and not the old one?
No, it's the new one. I can tell by the model number. So yeah, my big news would be that I have... Oh, actually, I decided to transfer this in the medium of puns. And actually, give a shout out to a friend of the show, Shelley, because these are her puns. But I have received an official promotion.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah, I'm now working at Te Papa, the National Museum of New Zealand, in their fish collection, messing around with all their fish. Yeah, I've only been here, it's about a month now, still settling in, massive culture shock, moved the whole family across the planet. You'd know about that. You know what that's like. It's easy.
I've also defected to the global south.
You fill out three forms, somebody stamps them, and then you've emigrated. And it's as simple as that, and there's no expensive forms or anything. So yeah, it's still getting used to it, but hopefully I'll have some interesting stories to share because it's a really active fish collection and wider museum. It's a big research museum. So yeah, watch this space for tales from the New Zealand collection.
Well done, Tom. Congratulations.
Thank you, mate. So there we go. In admin-y stuff, they're still getting patrons. We're still having new patrons join. It's really lovely. So shout out to the new patrons since the last time. Rebecca Cloud, Jake Hewitt, Ken Stowe, Megan Jones, thank you so much for helping support the show. And we have been, well, we've got a Discord for patrons, and it's been a lot of fun, actually. We're slowly building up people. We're building up topics to chat about. And yeah, after the last episode, you asked me to give you a link. And so now you're there. And how did you choose to express that, Alan? What are Tuesdays now? Can you remember?
Douche Tom Tuesday. So I've decided that every Tuesday I just tell all the patrons something embarrassing or horrible or stupid that Tom's done. So it's really high-end thinking man content.
Yeah, it's good. It's good, solid content.
Although I have to interrupt you there. We did forget Douche Tom Tuesday last week, and there's a good reason for that.
We did. Well, it's kind of done live.
Yes, I did it live. I just forgot to share it with the patron. But yeah, so Tuesday is the day that if you want to be horrible to Tom, confine it to a Tuesday, please.
Yep, that's fair enough. I look forward to having the input from that. The other things that we had on, we had some brilliant fan art. So one of our patrons, Anything But Snow, was inspired by your feud with Captain Barnacles from the Octonauts and drew a really lovely photorealistic polar bear wearing the Octonauts little jaunty cap, which, as you know, Octonauts is a cartoon, but there is a real Captain Barnacles that is based on. And that's the one that Alan has a feud with.
Are we actually calling it a feud now?
I like it. I like a bit of celebrity beef. I think it's quite good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll take that.
Wait, I think in the episode you do threaten to fight him.
I don't think I threatened to fight him. I think I threatened to strangle him a little bit.
Oh, just as a warning.
Yeah,
just
to shut him up for a bit. That was all. I didn't mean any harm by it. Just wanted to strangle him.
Oh, okay then. We'll definitely post that fan art with permission. And that chat led on to she was interested in how to get involved in using her art for SciComm or taxonomic illustration. So we gave a few suggestions, but if anyone of our listeners, you know, has suggestions how to use your artistic talent to join sort of scientific outreach, you know, preferably to be paid for that talent, because artists get a lot of do it for exposure stuff, then listeners, please let us know if there's anything we should be talking about.
And you can join in on Douche Tom Tuesday as well.
You can. It's paywalled, but yeah, turns out everyone's got a price and I'll just be bullied online.
Yeah.
If you join the Patreon program. Oh, and thank you for anyone who bought merch as well. And just subscribing to the show. It all has been great. Do we have a soundtrack for this month, other than you making a cup of tea and having a good slurp?
Soundtrack? Oh, that's an interesting one. I personally don't have one because I live in a world of silence. I listen to two things. One is the sound of my own footsteps pacing around in a circle, or a combination of my footsteps pacing in a circle whilst eating nachos.
And the odd truck.
And the odd juggernaut coming screaming past every couple of minutes to just shake the place. So that's my music of the month.
Okay. All right. We can go with that. It can be a more abstract one. So what's been going on in deep sea news? There is an amazing sort of full-size 3D scan of the Titanic shipwreck captured. And this has been posted a few places online. You can watch some videos or sort of have a little look about it yourself. It's a sort of false color image, but it's a fantastically detailed 3D model of the wreck as it currently stands. Well worth having an explore of.
But spoiler alert, it's still wrecked.
Well, it's not healing.
Yeah, it's not magically put itself back together at all.
It's getting better. It's getting better.
It's not, though, is it? We spoke to Laurie about this last week. She can confirm, too, that it's still wrecked.
It's being munched on from within. Even the bits that look okay are just wafer thin now.
Yep.
There was a new cave eel discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Loving a bit of new cave stuff. The interesting thing about these ones is the eye on one side was getting covered in skin. So we were almost seeing the degeneration of the eye as this species sort of specializes for going further and further into the caves. There was only like three specimens, I think, so not particularly abundant, but they do seem to have the skin growing over their left eye always.
Why?
So that was...
There's an obvious big question there. Why would the skin grow over one eye and not the other? Why is it not symmetrical?
I'd want to see them in action. I'd want to see how they were lying. You know, are they lying sort of almost like a flatfish, like on their side with one eye pointing up and then the other one... It's sort of degenerating.
Maybe they swim round in circles in a clockwise manner in a pool, and they just need one eye to keep abreast on what's going on around them, but the other eye is just grinding against the wall.
Much like mackerel, their head shape changes.
Yeah.
That was a little factoid you came out with over the week.
Yeah, have you not seen mackerel in an aquarium?
I have. They don't look happy. Well, they look too stupid to be unhappy.
Yeah, the head completely changes shape. They've got this big brick head rather than the pointy one. And apparently, because I asked, I just said to somebody, that looks a lot like a mackerel if it wasn't for the head. And they went, aha.
It was once.
Well, that's what happens if you put them in a tank.
So why did you do that? Shush you.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that not suggest they're not supposed to be in a tank? Shush. Get out.
Get out. But enough of your sort.
Yeah.
Remember we covered the arguments about the origins of life and whether the furthest ancestral form was a sponge or a comb jelly?
Yes.
There has been a new chromosomal total genome sequencing sort of approach looking at changes in where genes fall on the chromosomes, because actually that bigger rearrangement, it's not likely to go back again. That would be like shuffling a deck of cards and getting the same.
Yeah.
So by looking at that, there is indication that it's now the comb jellies.
Ooh, the tinafores.
The comb jellies are the sister group to all multicellular life.
Who's got the record for the deepest tinafore?
As a guess, I'd say it's probably you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like to talk about it, but you know.
Don't want to brag, but since the chance to bring it up.
I mean, how often do tinafores come up in conversation? So I'm just taking the chance while I'm here, right?
Jump in while you can.
Yeah.
And the geologists are very happy that a deep ocean drilling project has finally revealed huge cores of mantle. So we now have samples of the Earth's mantle, which is a bit of a geology holy grail. So all of the rock knockers are very happy with their great new rocks.
Great.
Oh, and a noodle bar in Taiwan is serving giant isopod ramen.
I saw this and I've been asked by several journalists to talk about this at the moment and I'm not getting into this. This is just ridiculous.
I'm not engaging.
Utterly ridiculous. actually creating a giant isopod fishery so you can eat them with ramen. It's like, how could people be so stupid?
It's just weird factor, isn't it? They're a scavenger. It's not good eating.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It makes me mad.
Are they really trawling for them? Because that was the bit that I was surprised by, but I wasn't sure if it's kind of got confused in the reporting.
I don't know. You don't know what to believe when it's press only, right? Because they can go all over the shop on this. But if they genuinely are trying to create this sustainable or whatever it is, what they say, the word sustainable is really prickly these days, but basically fish giant isopods for novelty food, it's just... I can't imagine there's much meat on them anyway, because the reason why we eat prawns is because prawns have that big chunk of white muscle on the tail, which they use for backward escape responses. That's the prawn, that's the bit that you eat. But giant isopods don't have that. And so you would be just ripping it little tendons and little fleshy bits within an exoskeleton. It's like eating a giant cockroach.
Yeah, it doesn't have claws like a lobster.
Yeah.
There's no real dense muscle in there. Unless they're bycatch from trawls. And I was speaking to someone at the conference, which we'll allude to what we're going to be talking about. They do turn up as bycatch every now and then, and maybe that's not so bad. But if I was going to try and fish these things, they go into a trap so willingly.
Yeah.
So happily do they go into a trap. I don't think you need to drag anything across the seabed.
Yeah, not a fan of the old giant isopod fishery, though, if it is such a thing.
Not at scale. As one little, like, weird novelty dish, then, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's an odd one. I don't think it's going to take off, and I think just... by shock value and people talking about it is the sort of only thing it's got going for it, really. I did hear from friend of the show, Merrill, who has recently qualified as a subpilot. And so I asked her to record her initial experiences, basically.
Ooh.
What sort of outfit she's working for, what it's been like. And so here is what Merrill had to say.
Deep Sea Podcast listeners. My name is Merrill and I work as a submersible pilot for a luxury cruise ship company. I'm one of a team of about 16 pilots from a wide variety of backgrounds working across two purpose-built expedition ships, each of which carry two submersibles. We use these subs to take passengers diving in the polar regions and many of the other interesting parts of the world that these ships visit. These are submersibles, of course, and not submarines. We are untethered and we move around freely, but we do need to return to the mothership at the end of a day's diving. In the Antarctic Peninsula, where I was working in this past season, that's the southern summer, this meant that our maximum dive depth was generally somewhere between 100 and 120 metres. Not super deep, fair enough, but incredibly interesting, especially because in these cold waters, you find a lot of species at a relatively shallow depth that are usually found far deeper. Often what happens is we go right down to the bottom and we investigate the rich benthic communities we find there. At other times and other places, we end up exploring walls or drop-offs. When we brief passengers about what they might see during the dives, we start off by telling them what they won't see. And in the Antarctic, what they won't see is whales and ice. Whales tend to avoid submersibles like ours because we use sonar to help us navigate. And the pings from the sonar are not sounds that they like. And of course, we're going to avoid ice for the same reason that small boats on the surface are going to avoid ice. Icebergs, as you know, are inherently unstable and they can capsize without notice as bits melt off or break off and their center of gravity shifts. So no whales and no ice. What we do see are rich benthic communities, including large glass sponges that may be thousands of years old. A lot of organisms here, of course, are sessile filter feeders, but we also often see big Antarctic sun sea stars, also known as wolf trap starfish, and sometimes also encounter Antarctic cod, though fish are not super abundant in this ecosystem and they tend to hang out relatively motionless on the bottom unless they're disturbed. In the water column itself, we can see selps, either as individuals or long chains, jelly animals, and also jellyfish, like the phantom jellyfish that was discussed a few episodes back. Towards the end of the season, what we were finding a lot more were dense swarms of Antarctic krill, Euphorbia superba, and to take the sub very slowly down through one of these thick clouds of krill is a truly amazing experience. In a few days, I'll be heading north to join the ship for several Arctic contracts. We'll be diving the subs around Iceland and Greenland in the Atlantic, and then navigating up through the Northwest Passage and the Bering Strait into the Pacific, exploring the coastlines of Arctic Canada and Alaska along the way. Until then, thank you for listening.
But the more eyes in the sea, the better. And actually, this is already paying off because one of Merrill's colleagues made an interesting observation of an anglerfish, and that has already been incorporated into a scientific paper. So this is like, this is kind of an extreme version of citizen science. But yeah, the more eyes in the ocean, the more chances we've got of seeing something interesting. And it's really good to link up scientists with those eyes in order to give it context. And rather than it just being an interesting observation, actually a scientific data point. Oh, listen to that tea.
This is like a whole new podcast.
It used to be a bit sort of laddie and leery and beery, but now it's just like Alan's cup of tea hour.
Yeah, come round. Come hither.
Oh, sit down. I'll put the fire on.
Yeah, let's talk about giant isopod fishing.
Make you a cup of tea.
Yeah.
So we got to hang out at the 10th International Crustacean Conference, which was being organised with NIWA, who's like the version of NOAA down here in New Zealand, and the Papa Museum. So you were over as a keynote speaker, Alan.
I was.
And it was a chance for us to catch up for the first time in ages, get down the Welsh bar, the only and slash best Welsh bar in the Southern Hemisphere, and catch up with loads of people we haven't seen since lockdown, since everything went a bit crazy.
That was great. And so I took the opportunity to go and see an old ship that I used to work on 10 years ago called the Kaharoa, because I know it's getting scrapped in, so I meant to pay homage. Managed to get the old First Officer Steve out of his beekeeping retirement. We went down to see it together, so that's cool. We saw a bunch of other scientists as well. Had lots of meetings offline and gave a little talk. And we got to go to the Welsh bar pretty much every
we
day.
Did. Yeah. And they remembered us despite it being 9 years, and that's probably a bad sign.
It's probably a bad sign, but they were very happy to see us again.
And they weren't being polite. They really did remember us.
Yes.
Oh, dear. And didn't he say, like, I was just telling someone about you the other day. How strange that you should come in. It's like, it's been 9 years.
We got off the plane about midnight, I mean, about 1 o'clock in the morning, walked in the Welsh bar, and the guy was still sat there. He's like, it's you. And he's like, you're still here, really? He's like, yeah. No, that's very cool. Love Wellington. Great.
Oh, I do love it here. It's a fantastic city. It's just weird. It's a really good kind of weird. Not many chains. Everything's like little bespoke shops.
Yes, it is good.
But it was an opportunity to chat to a bunch of people while they happened to be there. So sorry for the free and loose layout to this episode. It was just a chance to chat to lots of people as we got bumping into them at the conference. So Alan can attest to how horrible planning such a huge conference can be. It is a huge and stressful amount of work.
It was horrible. I don't think I'll do it again. I found it an absolutely thankless task. I didn't appreciate what was taken on at the time, but I won't say what conference it was because I hated every minute of it. And the backlash and the comments at the end were really quite horrid. And it was utterly thankless, and I'll never do it again.
There we go. That's Alan's day. But after the main conference had finished, just before the conference dinner, I managed to catch up with two of the key organisers to discuss how it all went and their thoughts and feelings on it. So here is
Corinne Schnabel and Rachel Pert. I always remember Rachel Pert's second name because the drummer in Rush is Ian Pert.
Oh, well, there you
I've
go.
Never asked him if they're related.
Can't be a common name.
No.
So I am here with Rachel and Corinne. So you guys put together the 10th International Crustacean Congress here at Te Papa Museum. You guys are both from NIWA, so it's just finished. You're beginning to relax. You're beginning to calm down. How's it been?
Yeah, we've had 4 days here at the National Museum Te Papa Tongarewa here in Wellington, and it's been the first International Crustacean Congress since 2018. So we haven't seen our colleagues for 5 years. Normally they're every 4 years, but because of COVID, there was more delays, and I didn't get to attend the last meeting. So it's the first time that we've actually seen each other in person. So I'm still buzzing from seeing our colleagues, who some of them we've seen on Zoom, or of course we collaborate and talk. But having everybody together was just
that's right. Just and then wonderful. There's all these names that have appeared since 2018 of people who are early career and students that have come through. And so it's really good to see them in person and just kind of connect and go, oh, okay, your work's that bit. And
Actually, that's an interesting one. Do you have any tips for a student, say, going into the conference for their first time? Like what a scientific conference is like?
It's really easy to get overwhelmed by all the people and all the people that seem to know each other. So having at least one face that you know and that is familiar is a really good jumping point. It's okay to latch on to people.
Yes, yeah.
And actually go, no, I'll go out with them afterwards, even though I'm exhausted and I'm totally wrung out, and just to maintain those networks.
The social moments are really, really powerful. The talks themselves, almost, it's a great chance to introduce yourself, to like, they put the face to the work. But yeah, it's the little relaxed bits afterwards where...
The talks are just the sparks, aren't they?
Yeah.
To put yourself out there. And that's really difficult to do, to put yourself into somebody else's face. But I think it, just about generally, the senior scientists are not scary.
There's a couple. I'm just going to say I'm still scared by a couple of them.
Just walk up to them or find some way to just have conversations. I do remember, it depends on the meeting too. I've been to meetings which made it quite difficult to connect, but I really am struck by how sociable our particular bunch of crustacean scientists are. And that came through at the closing session that we just had. And it's just a really wonderfully cohesive and sharing and very warm community, and really wraps itself around particularly the younger scientists as well.
Yeah.
And that really comes across.
You see the confidence build over the conference as they sort of relax.
Yeah, such a diversity of topics and people. And yeah, really, really successful. But I'm also really glad it's over.
You can finally relax. And they got a very sort of New Zealand welcome, a very Aotearoa sort of welcoming and structure to the conference. I know that we've got a lot of international visitors.
Yeah, that was very special. We thought we would, as you do in New Zealand, you welcome with a Maori welcome. But there's various levels of it, from saying hello to the full pōwhiri that we got, which was the invitation to the marae that we have at Te Papa, and welcomed by the iwi and residents and the local Taranaki whānui, Ngāti Toa. And it was just a really powerful way to be welcomed, with the sun shining through the coloured glass and the amazing marae. I think that was a really, really quite special experience to showcase, to welcome to New Zealand. The last one was in Washington, the previous one before that in Germany, the one before that in China. So our delegates have gone around the continents and taking in a little bit of that local culture. And this is the way to really, really showcase how we are welcoming.
Even though it was in completely in Te Reo Māori, I think people got the idea of the welcome, of the sense of place, of the connection that people have with other people and place.
That's great.
With a bit of comic relief too, because the other side, the welcoming side, does the welcoming in Te Reo Māori, and it was, we couldn't understand, or nearly all of the delegates couldn't understand, and there was like Māori, 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 break, crustacean, Māori, 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 and we all had to laugh. And that was one of those real icebreaker moments, which was quite
definitely
special.
Yeah, because it's such a grand atmosphere, it's quite an intense experience. Yeah. Then that little moment broke it, and it was like, no, it is a welcome.
And then we had a phenomenal kapa haka at the welcoming reception, which numerous people were in tears from Ngāti Toa, and they came, and it was very powerful, and a lot of people really were impacted by that. They were just like, oh, I feel really connected and welcomed. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Have you ever organised a meeting?
No, I haven't done it yet. I'm still very new to New Zealand, and yeah, I'm still learning, but I'm really enjoying learning. Yeah, Alan was a keynote speaker on the Wednesday, and then we had a deep sea session, lots of lovely amphipods, big flamboyant red ones.
They're wonderful. Alan, I did see a keychain on one of the backpacks.
Oh, okay.
One of those backpacks.
I had a tea strainer that was a Bethinella.
I do like merch. I do like that. Actually, jumping off from that, you guys had like a charity raffle. One of the things looked rather familiar.
Yes, so we have the Ray Manning Bazaar. So Ray Manning was a stomatopod worker way back when, and he passed away a little while ago. But people bring their crusty merch to each conference, and people do a silent bid, and the money goes to our student awards. And I contributed a face mask from the Deep Sea podcast of course, the crustacean, not the squid.
Of course. And I was aware of the conflict between the crustaceans and the fishy people, and they're like, oh, crustaceans are just fish food. So it was good that we had the I am your tongue now, just to keep us fish people in our place. It's like, eh, it's not a one-way street.
It's fantastic as a face mask, because really, it's in the right spot.
I was really surprised to see that. I really enjoyed that. So speaking of the student prizes, sorry to put you on the spot memory-wise, but...
I judged one of them. One of the side effects of organising a conference is that you can't actually get to see most of the presentations. But I did judge the main oral presentation student award winner, and she presented this really cool biochemical aspect of the crustacean eye. So there's these crystals, these crystalline structures that sit underneath the cornea of the shrimp, and how they they're physical. It's a collaboration between physicists and chemists and biologists looking at the distribution of these crystalline structures under a crustacean eye and how they adjust that to light. So these were different shrimp and larvae that were in estuarine settings and in deeper waters day and night, and the background color was actually being matched by these crystals. So the brackish browny estuarine waters, their eyes ended up being more yellowish, and then the open water, clear blue waters, their eyes looked quite a bit more light silvery or turquoisey, and then that was matched dorsal ventral back, you know, top and bottom with the background, the light and the dark. So
it's a camouflage thing.
It is a camouflage thing, and it is a really quick response in the way that these little crystals are being shuffled around, essentially. That's what my take was on that talk. I'm not a specialist, but I remember walking out of that talk and I wrote on my little judging sheet, favorite, and she ended up getting the top prize.
I think I've heard other people talking about that one. I think that was a good one that sort of murmured around the room a little bit.
Yeah, she was good.
Were there any other big ones? Were there any other ones that seemed to sort of send a ripple through the community? It's just like, oh, that was new, or that was cool.
One of the things which did really make an impact, I think, and first time that we've incorporated into the conference was the remembrances. So we've had a few years, and and a few of our colleagues have passed for various reasons, not COVID, but we've lost a few of our more senior colleagues and some of our younger colleagues as well. And some of it was really unexpected, and we gave some space to remember our colleagues, and we had a special eulogy session, and that really that was emotionally, you could see how everybody appreciated that, and we could all just send our love to those.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, especially with it being so long since the last one.
That's right.
And a lot has changed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they've given so much to us, so we kind of, in our way, just send them our love.
Yeah.
There was lots of cool imagery. It's just wonderful to see the photos.
Imagery's really leapt on. Like, it's some in situ stuff, but then lots of, like, scanning electron microscope stuff, and just really the detail just in the last decade has just shot up. I like a room of gasps. We've heard a few of those. Sometimes it's just a really good result, but sometimes it's just beauty, and you'll hear a few, and it's funny because you can tell the people who, like, really like that group, they're sort of fans for that particular group, and you'll get extra gasps of, like, oh, that's the best I've seen of these things.
Anna Helen Tamberg from Norway, her talk yesterday on the Hyperion amphipods on jellyfish.
Oh, yes.
Had some spectacular images of the jellyfish in black backgrounds, and it was just a stunning talk.
A real eye for design as well, because there were great images to start with, but then the whole talk, it fit into that visual style, you know, when a little thumbnail image could be used than a name. And so when you've had talk fatigue a little bit, and just, it was really a visual talk. She really lent into, like, yeah, I've got great images, but I also know how to use them.
That's right. I know this science, but it also shouldn't be boring because they're gorgeous.
You appreciate the beauty. And Alan's talk with all these amazing photos of those landers.
Seeing Alicilla moving and live. I've only ever seen them in jars.
Doing its thing.
Sorry. There's a lot of character to them. This is the supergiant amphipod.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember in the early sort of reports when we knew there was a giant amphipod down there, and knowing how the little ones behaved, it was like, this must be an apex predator. This thing must be a monster. But they're so gentle and lethargic and sort of glide in, and a little bit clumsy as well.
They look like the dumbest things out.
Well, they are.
Sorry, I don't mean to offend officials.
I will accept it with those. Yeah, in order to keep their calorie usage down, the brain has certainly been stripped back in a lot of deep sea fish. And they're one of their members of that family. I think even a congener, actually, has the record for the smallest brain-to-body ratio for vertebrates. Yeah, bony-eared assfish has the smallest brain-to-body ratio for vertebrate.
Their common name indeed is assfish.
Unfortunately so.
I worked on a meme, but it never made it off the ship. I went to the Kermadec Trench and all I got was an assfish. And I've got a little...
That's awesome.
I think it never made it to a t-shirt.
They're not great. They're kind of a muddy colour. They're very stupid looking. They are very stupid.
They've got tiny eyes.
Yeah. And to add to all of it, they're kind of phallic looking. So they've got very little going for them, but they're probably one of the most abundant fish on the planet.
That's awesome.
They are the peak of their branch in that phylogenetic tree.
You know, it's...
There's going no further.
What's that other meme? It's like, you may not like it, but this is what peak performance looks like. And as an abyssal predator, yeah, it probably is. Doing some digging, it was... Luckily, it's ass as in donkey.
Which spoils the fun. So, yeah, it's just...
Which is a weird common name to give for that thing as well.
Yeah.
We did a deep dive on why grenadiers are called that. And it was this whole thing went right back to bishop's hats and things.
Actually, we've been listening to your deep dive on the phronema, because we also, as one of the aspects of this congress is the crustacean, the clever crustacean, Mafititino, the Ave crustacean exhibition down at Te Papa, which is a small public traveling exhibition. There is a phronema in there as one of the heroes that are being showcased. And of course, the first thing that always comes up is it based on the alien? Your podcast has kind of helped a little bit in terms of setting that right. It came out just
had to
the
say
time.
To the comms people.
Oh, because they're desperate to like, they're yes, please, please.
And we kept pushing them away from saying it was all alien type things.
Oh, that's great. We enjoy digging around for that one. Yeah, it's a shame when it's a fun one, but yeah, we should strive for accuracy. That's the problem. It's the fun stuff that really propagates and it takes so long to unpick it.
Exactly.
So final breath of relief. But the fun's not over because some people are hanging around. Once you've got all these crunchy crustacean people in the same place, there's some work going on next week, isn't there?
That's correct. Yeah. So we're doing a systematics workshop Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, which Johanna and Jenny are coming to. And there's so many people coming through the collections because it's such an opportunity to come and have a look at what Niwa and Te Papa hold. So all these people go, my group? Could you pull out my group? So I could go in. And someone said to me, I just want to just wander through the collections and pull out the specimens that I want to look at. And they're not allowed to do that. So there are lots of people hanging around next week to look at further crusties.
Yeah, it's a long way to come and there's a lot of talent that's collected in the same place.
Yeah. New Zealand is just happens to be on a really unique place on Earth. It's so isolated. Yeah. It's so far from so many places. And we've determined that for the crustaceans, about 40% of the fauna is endemic. So we've got a lot of these animal groups and species, genera, families that are really unique that are missing in people's data sets and their genetic trees and their morphological comparisons. And so they are itching to get their hands on some of these animals that that we hold. And this is an opportunity to just nip next door.
And we're going to have a great opportunity to train up some younger scientists with some of the more experienced ones being here. We lured them in with the temptation of the collections.
We need new taxonomists.
I know, really do.
And I think it's almost been badly advertised, or there's this idea of like the meat librarian. And the collection is static and preserved and looks far into the future. But the use of it is dynamic and in the moment. And, you know, I was really surprised sort of behind the scenes at a collection, just how busy it is and how weird the requests are. And it is a public resource, not just for scientists, but for the general public. And so, yeah, this idea that this is a collection that has existed for hundreds of years gives it this static feel. And there is a lot of care for the specimens themselves. They are incredibly precious, but the people who use them are flitting around all over the place. And it's the cutting edge of a lot of research. It is not stagnant, or it's not the old way of doing things. I think it's really good that these young folk are getting to be excited about it. And on an emotional level, like being in the presence of the animals you study, you can't really top that. So still lots and lots to be done. Thanks so much for having a chat. Is there anything I've missed? Is there anything that would be handy to talk about?
Just the weird and wonderful world of crustaceans is out there. People think they're just tasty things to eat, or, you know, I've seen a crab, I've seen a lobster, but actually it's mind-bending.
Some spectacularly weird groups. Yeah. And even in the, like, more commonly known groups, there's some real oddballs. Like, here is the body plan. Let's see how much we can mess with it.
But it is one of the things that we're really trying to highlight in this little exhibition, is that, you might think you know a crustacean like a common crayfish, but most of the people don't know that the larvae looks like a transparent leaf that's blowing in the wind and traveling thousands of kilometers for years in these ocean currents.
Barnacles are actually crustaceans, not mollusks, which bends people's brains.
A barnacle is essentially a larval crustacean that's glued its face to a rock and is using its legs to filter feed. Those are the sorts of things that come as a surprise, and that's great to just try to share with the public.
Thanks so much for having a chat.
We also ran into our old crewmate, Tammy Frank, professor of Nova Southeastern University. She works a lot with Edie Widder, who we've had on the show, and she does a lot of work on deep sea crustacean vision, distribution, sort of interactions. Well, I pulled her away from the conference dinner, actually. She had drink in hand that was nibbles, and then I accosted her and took her off to have a quick chat. So there's a little bit of dinnery noise going on in the background. We tried to find somewhere quiet, but because drinks were in hand, we got told not to. So we just did it in the corner of the room. So here is some feedback from Tammy. We should probably do an intro. I'm here with Tammy Frank, professor of Nova Southeastern University, expert on crustacean vision. That'd be a fair bet.
Deep sea ecosystems, crustacean distribution patterns, and how light affects their distribution patterns during the day.
There we go. And sub veteran, you were just telling me how many sub dives you've had.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to have about 70. And I have to say, they're absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, even at 70, it's not getting old.
Every time, it's wonderful.
Oh, that's fantastic. Is there anything somebody doesn't quite acknowledge? You were just telling me that the sub you were using, the refractive index is the same as that of the seawater, so that whole sphere just disappears and you just feel like you're there.
Yeah, you feel like you're, it's a comfortable seat. The Alvin, which is the Woods Hole submersible, my friend described it as basically sitting under your desk for 8 hours because it's a very cramped environment and you have to bend on your side to look out the porthole. But the JSL takes 4 people, a pilot and a scientist in the front and an accessory pilot and a scientist in the back. And so in the front, you're basically sitting in a very comfortable chair. And so it's like sitting in your living room watching all the spectacular ocean life
whole
go by.
Panorama. Are you far enough forward? You get sort of a full 180? You get sort of to...
Yeah, in the front you do.
Yeah. You get the IMAX. You sort of lose your peripheral vision and you just get to be there.
And it's nice because it's a very thick plexiglass sphere, so it's temperature insulated. Being someone who doesn't metabolize very well, it gets very, very cold. The back is an aluminum sphere. So in the Gulf of Maine, when it's 7 degrees centigrade outside, it's just about 7 degrees centigrade inside.
Right. So beyond the fantastic view, it's worth getting that front seat just for the warmth.
It is. I mean, in the back, we go down wearing normal clothes, but then come out looking like a Pillsbury Doughboy because we slowly pile on layers. And so by the time the dive is over, we're little frozen tidbits wearing hats and mittens. And even though it's warm outside, the hull in the back hasn't warmed up yet. And so for us, it's absolutely freezing.
Oh, and it's not like you're moving around.
It's still worth it. Still worth it. I'm willing to suffer the cold.
Even 70 times.
Yes.
What was your favorite experience in the sub? Is there anything that leaps out that's just like something amazing? Yeah?
My colleague, Edie Witter, we shared the sub dives because we were doing work in the Gulf of Maine. So one time she would go down the front, the next time I would go down the front. And because she's a bioluminescent expert,
Edie's been on.
Okay, cool. that bioluminescence is mechanically stimulated. And so we would turn off the lights when we went up, we went down. And Edie has a classic quote that everybody seems to remember where she said, "It's like the 4th of July down there," which is a big holiday in the States because it's our Independence Day. And she's absolutely right. It's like explosions of fireworks going off.
I need to see it. I've seen glimpses of bioluminescence, but I've not been, I don't know, that being immersed in it, especially long enough down there that your eyes have adjusted and it's sort of revealing itself.
Once you get down by about 500 meters, there's not much downwelling light for us to see. And so the bioluminescence is so bright that any motion at all, you'll see it. You don't really have to be dark adapted.
Well, that's amazing. So how did you find the conference?
Very interesting. I learned things that I didn't know. I learned that I'm glad I'm actually not working in genomics because I don't find phylogenetic trees that interesting. But there were a lot of deep sea amphipod talks here that I don't really know that much about them, and that was very interesting. And then Megan Porter gave a dynamite talk on vision, which is my specialty, so of course it was a dynamite talk.
Was that the crystals in the eyes?
No, that was a student.
Yeah,
she won. That was her master's.
She won the student prize.
Yeah, and I was talking with her because all the time on the cruises, we see these little tiny larva forms, look at them in the microscope, and they have bright blue eyes. And my students was asking, why are they blue? I said, I really don't know. But because of her talk, now I know Waller Blue, and it's actually extremely interesting. So that actually probably made the conference worthwhile for me. It's usually that one talk that stands out where you go, I had no idea, and now I know.
And in a field you're familiar with, it's when you're just like, that's what that is. I've been looking at that for years.
Exactly. Unfortunately, she finished her master's, and now she's going off in a different direction.
No!
Because I told her, you know, we get these. She was talking about that she didn't have a lot of crabs. She had mainly shrimp larvae. And a lot of what we see in our cruises are crab larvae with blue eyes. And so I was going to offer to send her pictures or collect some for her, but... she's shifting topics.
What could possibly tempt her away?
Well, she said actually her passion is chemistry. And so this project was a huge collaborative project between chemists and ecologists and biologists. And so...
well, leaving on a high.
Yes,
indeed. Student talk winner.
Yeah, exactly. And well-deserved, I think. Her research was excellent, and her presentation of the research, which was very clear on a topic that most of us don't understand that well.
Fantastic. Yeah. What was the other talk that stuck with you?
There was a talk on amphipods feeding on bait at depth of 6,000 meters and then I think 850 meters. And apparently snailfish aren't found below 6,000 meters, or they weren't until Alan discovered one in his latest.
But in the trench they were in, yeah, the 8,200 would have been beyond the fish.
Yeah. And so he showed video of, in the one case, initially the amphipods were on the bait, and then a snailfish came in and just decimated the amphipods. And he showed us the gut contents, and it was filled with amphipods. And the odd thing is the amphipods never came back. So even though there was, the snailfish don't eat the bait, only the amphipods do. Even though there was plenty of bait left, the amphipods never came back. In the deeper site where there's no snailfish, the amphipods decimated that bait within like 24 hours.
And to make it clear to our listeners, the bait was a whole dolphin. It wasn't a small, it wasn't a mackerel.
Right, yeah, no, it's a big fish.
Yeah. Oh, I just love seeing that many snailfish all at once.
That was really, really
interesting. We've not gone so long term. So yeah, seeing a great big pile of Mariana Trench snailfish was, that was the
and
treat
I mean,
for me.
His study was, they must have had remarkable funding to be able to go down that deep repeatedly. But they went down on day one and like day three and then day 10 and day 20 and day 30. And my question was, how on earth do you get the funding to have that many submersible dives repetitively in 1 year?
Yeah, lucky, lucky.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for taking a second to talk to me. I'm sorry pull you away from a lovely dinner and better company than me. But thanks for having a chat with us.
Happy to do it.
I first met Tammy Frank in 2007, which was the first ever trench job I ever did. The idea was that her and the bioluminescence folks and the brain surgeons were trawling at like 500 meters, 1,000 meters, and we were firing these things down to 10,000 meters. So she was kind of hanging around all the time. It's fascinating what they do. It's all brains, light, optics, lots of crustaceans. So she's a fascinating person. She's almost the last one of that old guard of bioluminescent science, you know?
She's good fun. She was a good chat. She was good company at the conference.
Yeah.
And she accidentally found the podcast when I mentioned it. So she's probably listening now. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Tammy.
And apparently when Ash was getting the permission to talk on the show from Niwa, the comms person became a listener. So hello, Niwa's comms person.
Hello.
I'm local now. Say hi.
I've just remembered a Tammy Frank fact. She can speak German.
She can speak German. She can.
She can.
That bombshell of a fact.
Yeah. Who would believe? Who could believe it? One of those bilingual people. Oh. No. Lovely, lovely, lovely person. Great working with her.
Yeah. She's good fun. I also got a chance to meet in person and chat with Henry Knauber. Oh, sorry if I've butchered your last name. I didn't check how it was actually pronounced. So sorry, Henry. But I realized we've actually been speaking before about communicating the deep sea and fun SciComm outreach and how to sort of make science more accessible. And he's really taken that and he's running with it. So Henry has some brilliant German language content over at Instagram at Bissell Arium. We'll put links in the show notes. And I was really impressed with the quality of it. So we chatted when he was first thinking of sort of putting something like this together. And now it's like a really mature channel. So I know we have listeners in Germany. If you get bored of our silly voices and you want something really good in your native tongue, or you fancy learning some German, Henry's stuff's really good. So check it out.
I we're taking a quick little sidebar with Henry Canova just to have a chat, because we realised, well, thankfully you reminded me, but we'd actually had a little chat together on the Deep Sea Society Discord.
Yes, Deep Sea Biology is a symposium, I think it was.
But we were chatting about science communication.
Exactly.
And how to talk to people about the deep sea without going monsters.
Yes.
And so how has that been? Like, what have you done?
Yeah, ever since I picked up my PhD, that basically started right after DSBS, where we both got to talk a bit. I also started to do a SciComm project besides a German one, because there are a lot of people out there on social media that you can follow that do deep sea SciComm in English. But I was thinking that we lack something like that for a German audience.
And we know from our stats we have German listeners. So
yes, that is nice. That's wonderful. But I mean, I'm one of them. So
but what a bar to entry. You know, it's, science is hard enough anyway without a second language sort of filter
yes.
working on it.
Well, my whole, or the whole idea behind starting that was that people kept approaching me when I was talking about my work, being like, oh my God, that's so interesting. So I could see that people are interested in deep sea science, but what's missing for them is an access point to get into deep sea science. And I just feel very comfortable and enthusiastic talking about the deep sea. So why not put a little bit more effort in it and make it SciComm?
Where can we find you? Where can we find you?
Yeah.
SciComm?
So I have a website that basically just serves as a backlog by now for all the stuff I'm researching and putting together for the main SciComm channel, which would be on Instagram at abyss.arium, abyss.arium on Instagram, where I'm basically just doing a lot of different stuff, like obviously stuff from my PhD work right now, when I'm attending conferences, congresses. Also, we've been doing an expedition last year where I did a lot of filming besides actually working on the samples. And
so if folk want to know what it's like on an expedition, you did sort of daily diary.
Exactly. Like just taking some short video footage and answering some questions, of course, when people ask about how's life on a research vessel.
Did they ask about the food? They always ask
yes.
about the food.
And since
why is that so interesting?
I have no idea.
It's burger and chips. Like, I found a new species, but you want to know about
yes.
the burger and chips.
Well, we didn't have burger and chips, in fact, because German research vessel, so very German-heavy cuisine, which actually was even at some point so exhaustingly German that at some point when we actually came into the harbor of Vancouver after 6 weeks, we were all just going to the next Asian restaurant, ordering some vegetarian stuff because we were craving it so heavily. But yeah, amongst that, also questions regarding like sampling, what do we find, and how's life in general? What's your daily routine on a research vessel?
What was the weirdest question that you got? And did it like unlock a lot of stuff with you? Because sometimes you don't think about this stuff until someone asks.
There was one question I got recently, not connected to the deep sea expedition, which nobody asked me before, which was, is there anything you are scared about? The deep sea. Wow. And for deep sea scientists, I think this is a difficult question because
this is one we get a lot.
Yes. Usually we just like people ask you what's the most fascinating thing or what's your favorite animal? But something that actually scares me about the deep sea, I really had to think about it and I actually didn't came up with an answer.
Well, they ask you with a smile on their face. They
yes.
ask you like,
yes.
scare me. Tell me a scary story. And you go to the scary place. And that's kind of what we're trying to push back on. It's like,
yes.
It's
like all
place.
These tropes with like, I think it's just this common misconception that we have like some animals which are just very large and some animals that look very creepy, but are in fact like very tiny.
Yeah.
And then in people's mind, they just fuse together to like some giant monsters. But in fact, at least for my research, we're tackling very small isopods, just a few millimeters in size, smaller than your common roly-poly in your garden or cellar. So they're cute. And
nice scanning electron microscope, you know, if you forget
yes,
the size. You know,
yes.
They're mighty beasts. But yeah, it's that pressure to deliver that entertainment of the horror show.
Yes. Well, we can always diverge basically to those fascinating animals, because we have a lot of very weird, of course, creatures, not necessarily horror creatures, but just very fascinating in the way they live. And talking about xenophores, for example, which always look nice, or barrel eye fish or something like that. There's dozens of examples of very fascinating deep sea creatures.
Yeah, and go for the cool factor. You can sort of entice them in and then change their mind a little bit.
Yes, that's the aim, cool. I guess.
This
yeah.
is why you should care about deep sea.
Yes.
Stuff. Oh, very cool. So how did you find your first proper full-on cruise?
Well, I'm in a working group in Frankfurt that does just a whole bunch of crustacean research, mainly deep-sea isopods under the leadership of Dr. Angelika Brandt. Yes, yes,
okay.
yes. And she's been doing like a lot of deep sea expeditions in the last decade along Hadal Trench systems in the Northwest Pacific.
She's a powerhouse.
She is going. Yes, yes. And last year, we finally made it work after a couple of years of planning to actually go to the Aleutian Trench, complementing our research that we previously did on the Kuril-Kamchatka Trench, Japan Trench, and neighboring basins, basically. And it was very exciting for me to join that, despite not being deeply involved into the project itself. But I could join. I did. Worked on some isopod samples from epibendic sledge samples and found also some specimens that actually benefit or that actually will benefit my PhD thesis as well and my research.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah, was it a long one?
6 weeks.
Okay.
Which for first deep sea expedition, yeah, that is one of the longer ones, I would say. But I gotta say, being on research vessel Sonne is probably the most comfy thing you can have.
Boat.
Yes, it is.
It is a nice
boat. Like every deep sea expedition I will do afterwards will have to compete.
It's a hard act to follow.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it can only go down from here without like insulting other research vessels around the globe.
It's a good boat.
It is a very good one.
It's not just that it's comfy. It has a good atmosphere. It has a friendly atmosphere.
Yes.
I found the marine crew.
We had a very good time. Obviously, like at some point, you get a little bit annoyed, I would say, being on sea for an extended period of time.
It's always the third week.
Yes, exactly.
Once I'm through the third week, it's not at the three-week mark. It is the third week always. That's when I get a little bit homesick. That's when I want to be off here. Once I get through that, I could do 6 weeks. I could do 3 weeks.
It's like,
bad. I don't know
it's
what
like
it is.
So 2 to 3 days where I just feel like very, I don't want to talk to you. Just let me do my work and finish. And after that, you're for some reason very comfortable and you just roll with it.
Did you come out with like intense friendships? Because like 6 weeks at sea in the real world where you're saying going out for drinks or going to the cinema, like that's a 2 year friendship.
Yes.
Into 6 weeks. And it's a hard environment. And
for sure. I was lucky enough to share a cabin with a colleague from Frankfurt and a good friend of mine, which was very comfy. Also met a lot of young scientists there because we actually had to change the staff for the expedition very shorthanded. And yeah, I haven't met most of these people again ever since the expedition, but we're still keeping in touch. And whenever we should somewhere on this planet run into each other, I am quite certain we will just be right back to the vibe we had on the research vessel.
Oh, no, that's how it is, because it's such a small community, and it might be 15 years, it might be 20 years,
yes,
but you'll fall straight back into it, because like it's
absolutely
such a pressure cooker, like, you know, to be friends and enemies, really.
it's an intense time, for sure, like an intense class trip, with its ups and downs, for sure.
Yeah.
But I guess most of the people, if not all, I can judge, would definitely just go straight for the next one if they could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic opportunity. It's hard. It's hard work, but it's
yes,
a great opportunity. And you did this like in COVID times, in the dark times.
Where... Yes. It was troublesome and definitely also didn't help lift the mood on board. But we pulled through, and it's one for the books that we now actually had research or deep sea expedition with a pandemic going on.
Yeah, and one of few people without a gap in their data set.
Yes, we actually just went there and pulled through.
Nice one.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for chatting with me.
Well, it was a pleasure every time again.
So one more time, Instagram is?
At abyss.arium.
Great, go check
it out. Thank you very much.
Especially if you're German speaking.
Yes.
I'm sorry you have to listen to us. There should be better things.
So Henry speaks German as well, given that he's German.
Oh, is there a theme?
I don't know. It just seems to be naturally evolving. Like so.
Well, they like their marine science. They do a lot.
They do. Love the German ships.
Actually, yeah, the German ships are really good fun.
Did you ever go on Meteor?
I feel like I might have done as part of the Coralfish project, but...
Yeah, Meteor's a fine vessel as well. Meteor's great. The old Zonne was my favourite. The new Zonne is great, but the old Zonne had loads of character. It was wonderful. It had history. You could see every, you know, it was just... like an old, really old car. It's probably had multiple owners. It's wonderful and it just worked amazingly. I don't know why I'm getting all reminiscent about old ships this episode, but there you go.
It's because you said goodbye to the Kaharoa. That was quite... Now we realise that they disappear as well. Like we've all got our favourite ships. We've all got the ones that we really had a good time on. And then to realise that they are themselves mortal and that someday they too shall pass.
Well, the thing that got me about Kaharoa, because Kaharoa was one of these things that sort of made my career. Because it's when I first started going out on my own and doing this ridiculous deep stuff. And, you know, fair enough, we started it on the old Zonne, but
really came into my own using Kaharoa. And, you know, we asked the first time we found the supergiants and the snailfish, and the first time we got to like 10,000 meters and, you know, took it all the way to New Caledonia back. But with the benefit of a little bit of age / wisdom.
And the odd mega yacht, let's be fair.
To be fair, lots of mega yachts and some support vessels and everything else. Well, Steve and I went down to see it. It was great to see Steve again because, you know, he's not even worked on Kaharoa for a long time either. Went down, got on board. I'm just like, wow, that's small. Like, how on earth did we do that? I just don't know. The, you know, the four-man cabin with the...
Four people in that cabin.
I know. I don't think I've got it in me now, which is weird because I'm talking about going to sea for the next 2 months. But actually, since the last podcast, I've been to sea as well. It was a little short one that a colleague did the 3 weeks, but I went on for the first 2 days. And I remember looking at this boat. We only went off Perth Canyon down to 4,000 whatever meters. And I was looking at that one going, man, this is as small as a Kaharoa, you know? And we went out in Perth. To get to 4,000 meters in Perth, there's only about 8 hours. By the time we got out there, I'm just barfing all over the place. Like, it's been a long time since I've been on a small boat. I was like really ill. And we put out this massive big mooring line and all the rest of it. And I came back. I was like, oh, that's like the Kaharoa days, you know, you puke for the first 2 days.
That's all it was.
But then when I went to see Kaharoa, I'm like, that's even smaller. I thought they were both about the same size, but Kaharoa is even smaller. I can't believe we took that.
Across the South Pacific.
All the way to the middle of Kermadec Trench, all the way across the South Fiji Basin, all the way to New Caledonia, and then back again. And oof, jobs for the young men, I reckon. I can't do that anymore.
But we can always brag about it, how we cut our teeth doing that.
Yeah, brag about it, yeah. But just not doing it again. So I've decided from now on...
You don't have to, you've done it.
From now on...
Delegate now.
It's big boats. Big boats only.
With helidecks and skybars.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, and that sums up this slightly unusual episode, but thanks for sticking with us. We now have a support page to help keep the podcast going. So we've listed lots of ways of helping the show, from the free, like leaving a review, subscribing, to becoming a patron or sort of buying the merch. On that track, we are also open to any advertisements. If you'd like to advertise with the show, we've got a very informed, passionate, science and deep sea loving audience. If you would like to reach them, then we can offer chances for that. So you can check out the many ways of visiting us in the show notes. And I think that concludes it. Who knows what the next one will be like? Who knows if we'll even have you for the next one, Alan? You're going to have to check out what the...
I don't know. We may have to do a little practice run. I'll maybe have to try and time it so we're alongside in Hawaii or something like that. I don't know. But I've got a question, though, about this whole patronage Discord thing. That's a fans-only thing, right?
It is. So don't say only fans.
That's different. Is that's different from only fans, then, is it?
It's not gotten that bad yet. But since I'm already like pimping myself out, yeah. Okay, coming next month, the deep sea only fans, where you'll see us only wearing a giant isopod or something like that. Oof. That's what the people want, isn't it?
I think that is exactly what people want, Tom. Make it happen.
Yeah, whatever it takes to keep the podcast going.
All right.
I'll do that.
All right. But at the moment, it's fans only, so I can put my trousers back on.
Well, I don't know. It gives you a sort of interesting energy, especially with the cup of tea in hand. Cup of tea, trousers down.
I haven't stopped walking. This entire chat, I have not stopped pacing up and down.
Get your steps in. It's good for the energy levels.
Well, yeah, because my exercise yard is just a little balcony. Yeah,
that's your it. Exercise yard. You pace like a caged tiger.
Yeah, the folk up the road have got a swimming pool and an outside restaurant.
You can hear them having fun.
Oh, no, they're miles away. They're well away from me. Their biggest issue is they've got snakes. They've got rattlesnakes up there. No rattlesnakes in here.
They wouldn't be allowed in. They'd have to quarantine. So yeah. If one comes in, you've got to keep it.
Do you know, I've gotten that board that I'm actually starting to build a jetpack out of my recycling.
Updates, please. So you're going for full Mandalorian jetpack?
Yeah.
Because that's just a box and some tubes.
When it's time to leave, I'm going to light it and jump off the balcony and see if it works.
I don't think this is good for you, mate. I don't think it's good for you to be on your own.
No. It's only day three as well.
Left with your own thoughts.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. But no, yeah, it comes a time in every man's quarantine where he has to build himself an imaginary jetpack. In fact, it's not imaginary, it exists. It's just made of two pizza boxes, some kitchen roll tubes and an old plastic orange juice bottle.
Pictures, please. Pictures for the feed.
Of course. I was using two expired COVID tests as my ignition switches for it. I'm really thinking about this. So I got a warning from the second engineer on the ship to try not fly too close to the sun. quarantine, eh?
So on that, we'll deep see you next time, and I'll miss you already. We'll be right back.
If you would like to advertise with the Deep Sea Podcast, feel free to get in touch. Our audience is primarily young people with an interest in science, often undergraduates or people considering a degree in marine science, but it also includes established scientists. Feel free to get in touch if you're interested in reaching these groups.
Why do I feel so much better for hearing that?
It's my second one. You know, I just made another cup of tea while you were yabbering away there.
No, I could hear you pottering around. I could hear little clinks and tinks in the background.